way because he is all those things simultaneously, and he transcends all those genres. Tonight we are introducing his new book, The Library at Night, which is the threshold into a wonderful realm of dreams that only lovers of books understand very well. Now, he has written fundamental books that have been translated into many languages, like A History of Reading, Reading Pictures, The Dictionary of Imaginary Places, as I said before. Paul Holdengraber is going to hold the conversation with him tonight in a lively way. I just want to mention that this event has been sponsored by the New York Public Library and Instituto Cervantes, New York. Please welcome Alberto Manguel.
And thank you very much to you, Mr. Lago, and to Antonio Munoz Molina, with whom I had the pleasure of working on another event with the Instituto Cervantes some years back, 2 years back, I think, when we did an evening commemorating the 400 years of Don Quixote. I had never seen so many people coming to celebrate a dead writer. But it is a real great pleasure to have you here tonight. We've known each other for some years. I've been a fervent reader of both your real books and your imaginary books, and it's a pleasure to have you here in the flesh at the New York Public Library, so thank you very much for coming. I couldn't have planned it better with the New Yorker. I just got the New Yorker today, and I don't know if any of you have received it in your mailbox, but it is fantastic. It is a person standing on a huge tower. It nearly looks like the Tower of Babel, standing on a tower of books. So thank you very much for this promotion for this event today to the New Yorker. You have been introduced to some of the books of Alberto Manguel, so I won't repeat them. I'll just let you know that one of my first encounters with Manguel was A Dictionary of Imaginary Places. The director of the library, who is here tonight, David Ferrero, told me that when he was the director of the MIT library, he put this book in the reference room, which I think is perfectly a good thing to do, to give and very impish, I might say. We do get on for that very reason. I can mention a number of other books. Manguel has recently written a book commemorating his relationship as a reader of Borges. He was, in fact, Borges's reader, as you know. Borges,
one of very, very many.
One of very many readers. As you know, Borges was blind, and so Manguel read to him. It's a book which was just published. It's called With Borges. I won't make you feel too anxious by going through your whole.
Thank you.
I think you, I can feel the anxiety building. And it's a pleasure to have Manguel here because I've always admired what someone once referred to as his gentle erudition. And what a great occasion to be here at the New York Public Library in the trustees' room at night to talk about the library at night. And if I had had my wherewithal and contemplated this evening a little bit more, I would have definitely invited you all to go into the stacks afterwards, which is something we really should have done in any event. Let me begin, and let's start from an uplifting point of view. Your book is divided in many extraordinary chapters. One of them is called The Library as Power. Mm. And you have there a quotation which is particularly uplifting from Samuel Johnson. In The Ramble on the 23rd of March, 1751, he writes, "No place affords a more striking conviction of the vanity of human hopes than a public library." And I thought we would start with that and have you comment on that.
Thank you for making things easy.
It's always a pleasure.
I think that when we walk into a space such as the New York Public Library, we realize that it is not merely a place in which we keep books or merely a place in which we come and read books, but symbolically it stands for something that makes us realize the power of the idea of the book. And it is striking that up to the early 20th century, this idea of the book and the library having a central place in our society was reflected in its architecture. Looking at the architecture of so many of the libraries built today, I think we can see that there has been a shift, and what was once considered a central symbol has really become a monument to the architect's megalomania or the idea a politician might have of how he wishes his name to be preserved.
So what some people call the edifice complex.
No doubt, of which a good example is the National Library of Paris, where the architect decided that since a library houses books, the library should be built in the shape of four open books, and not realizing that readers use the library and so have to cross a huge space, terribly dangerous, especially if you're older than 20. And the towers themselves were glass towers in which the books were housed. Now, the first thing any reader knows is that the one place in which you don't put books is in the sunlight under the heat of the and the light of the sun. So they had to mask these towers with wood.
So the architect forgot both, if I'm correct according to your description, forgot both the books and the public.
Yes, the architect believed that this was a monument and not a place to which readers go to read. But this is because so many of these architects are not readers, and nobody tells them what these buildings are for. On a happier note, the older buildings, such as this one, continue to exist and continue to remind us of this symbolic power.
Now, in the introduction to your book, The Library at Night, an introduction I might say once again, happily enough, you completed on the 30th of January 2005, 1 year ago. You write the following: in my foolhardy youth, when my friends were dreaming of heroic deeds in the realms of engineering and law, finance and national politics, I dreamt of becoming a librarian. Slothened and ill-restrained fondness for travel decided otherwise. Now, however, having reached the age of 56, which according to Dostoevsky in The Idiot is the age at which real life can be rightly said to begin.
That was 2 years ago.
I can't tell you how much I have something to look forward to. I've returned to that early ideal, and though I cannot properly call myself a librarian, I live among ever-increasing bookshelves whose limits begin to blur or coincide with the house itself. The title of this book should have been Voyage Around My Room, Voyage Autour de Ma Chambre. Regrettably, over two centuries ago, the notorious Xavier de Maistre got there first. So, you've wanted to be a librarian for a long time. I could ask you how long you've had that problem. So, in your view, what constitutes a librarian, or what are you aspiring to now that you are slowly moving into that realm?
Librarian, this in the sense in which I wanted to be a librarian, was simply somebody who lives among books. Librarians in the real world are heroic figures who continue to defend this symbol of the library as the core of our society. And the mildness of librarians is very deceiving.
You have a few examples in the book.
Well, there is a wonderful example given by Nicholson Baker concerning the Library of San Francisco, where you know that having found that the library was too small to keep all the books they had, they commissioned one of these modern libraries and discovered that the new library was even smaller. So the solution that the administrators found was, since the books couldn't be given away or sold because they were municipal property, was to use them as landfill. So how do you choose the books to condemn to a landfill? These administrators decided that any book that hadn't been borrowed in the past, whatever, 15 years, was then condemned to the landfill. Now, these are people who believe that books like eggs have got a sell-by date. So you judge the book according to how many people have solicited it in the last little while. And this is where the heroic librarian comes in, because the librarians crept into the library at night and stamped the books with fake dates to save them.
Give it for the librarians.
Absolutely.
You have a few other examples, which I know it's endless. I mean,
it's endless.
Now, heroic librarian. It could be the name of the next book. But but for instance, describe Sholem Aleichem and the librarians who saved those books. I mean, I think that is a very interesting story.
Well, that was one of the many stories in during the Nazi era, where people risked their lives to save books. The most moving of these stories is not perhaps the saving of books, but the building of a library, because next to Auschwitz, as you know, they built the camp of Birkenau for the children. And they had one section of the camp that carried the number 31, which they would show to visitors as an example of how well the Nazis treated the Jewish children. The children were kept there for 6 months and then sent to the extermination camp. And during the time that they were there, the adults who were in charge of looking after the children, who were inmates as well, managed to secure 8 books. This was the Birkenau Library. And we know that of those books, one was H.G. Wells' Short History of the World, another was a book of geometry, another was a book of fairy tales. And the older girls were in charge of hiding those books in a different place every night. This took place day after day and night after night at a time in which any gesture, any act could mean that it was your last one. This goes, of course, beyond heroics. It tells us somewhere that essentially the power to be a reader is the power that allows us to realize what it is to be human. See, I believe, but this is maybe carrying it too far, that as human beings, we come into this world as reading creatures. That we come into the world with an impulse to decipher everything, that we believe that everything is text, everything is narrative, whether we have composed it in order to transmit a story or whether it is simply the landscape that surrounds us. We believe that everything around us is
text. And then what happens?
And then we read. And then we read. We read in order to know what the world is. We read in order to know who we are. The old metaphor of the world as a book that we read and in which we too are read, I think, reflects this impulse that we have.
Let me ask a question again, and then what happens? By that I mean to say we may start out as animals who read, but I know that you have less than kind things to say about the way in which we are educated now to become non-readers.
Because I think that we, when we come into the world as reading creatures, we come into the world also as intelligent creatures. And this intelligence is a muscle that we need to exercise. And reading trains us to think. But you can also be trained to become stupid. Stupidity is something that needs to be learned. And I think that almost everything in our society today wants to train us to become more and more stupid. Because if with this stupidity, then you won't ask for things that are slow and difficult, which are two negative qualities in our society today, but they were not always negative.
So difficulty is a value.
Difficulty is a value, slowness is a value, but we are taught that the qualities of everything today is quickness and ease. I saw an ad for a power book the other day that says faster than thought. Faster than thought. I need to reflect on this for
me
a
too.
Moment.
I'm not sure I quite get it. No, anyway, yeah.
Excuse me. This idea that what is quick is good and what is easy is better is a very recent idea. When the Venerable Pede in the 4th century wants to give an example of the brevity of our life, to lament the brevity of our life, he describes it as the flight of a bird that enters a lit hall from the night outside and flies out back into the night. And this quick flight is our life. Well, the Venerable Bede was lamenting this brevity. We would use it to speak of how wonderful a new electronic system is. Quick as the flight of a bird through a lit hall.
It reminds me of the wonderful passage in Calvino's memos for the next millennium, where he talks about lightness and reminds us of the Latin quotation of festina lente, mm-hmm. Take haste but slowly. Mm-hmm. You are now living, you have abandoned Canada.
No, I have not abandoned Canada. I am Canadian. I was born in Argentina. I live in France, but I am Canadian, and I have not abandoned Canada. See, I became Canadian because it was a choice. I don't believe in being imposed a nationality just because you happen to be born there. Adhering to a nationality before you reach the age of reason seems to me absolutely mad. It's like an arranged marriage. When I arrived in Canada, I was over 40. And
what attracted you to Canada?
Chance. See, there's nothing to attract you to Canada because Canada, Canada doesn't have a clear identity. Canada defines itself through its openness and takes in the nationalities that come to Canada. So Canada is that pink space on the map. It's the place that in our imagination is there not to find but to get lost in. At the end of Frankenstein, Frankenstein's monster loses himself in the frozen north. What is that frozen north? It's Canada. That's where you go when you want to lose yourself. And I instead found myself there because I found for the very first time, having lived in Argentina and then having lived in Europe, that this was a place where I could suddenly have an active role as a citizen. And that in order to have that role, I didn't have to compromise anything else. I didn't have to become a politician, God forbid. And I could do something. And I did for a number of years.
I gather you don't feel quite the same of north of south of Canada, this particular country.
Here, you mean?
Yes.
I have no idea because I've never lived in the United States. But in
the United
Canada,
States doesn't embrace you in the same way you would.
No. You see, in Canada, the United States looms large. I'm not sure that it is the same in the United States. I don't think Canada has considerable weight in the American psyche.
I think you're right.
You know, there since you mentioned Borges, someone once brought to Borges the French edition of Ernesto Sábato sobre Héroes y Tumbas. And the book carried a band that said, Sábato, Borges's only rival. This was read out to Borges, and Borges said, how intelligent, Sábato. I would have never thought of writing Borges, the only rival of Sábato.
Let me try again and say, you didn't abandon Canada, but you are now living in France.
Yes.
Okay. Where I mean to go there is to talk a little bit about your library.
Yes.
And I have great fondness to talk about libraries because I spent so many years of my earlier years writing about Walter Benjamin, who wrote an essay that I obsessed about called Unpacking My Library. Mm-hmm. And you describe quite exquisitely, I might say, how you came to this house and how you discovered a place where finally you could put to rest.
Not to rest, because a library never rests.
This is true. You could put the objects that constitute a library on shelves.
Yes.
I agree that books are not necessarily objects. You could put those dear possessions that had never had a home all together in enough space.
Mm-hmm.
And you imagined the library actually before it existed.
I did. I had in mind the library of my high school. I went to the Colegio Nacional de Buenos Aires, where there was a library that I loved to read in. It was paneled in dark wood and had green lamps over the tables. And I thought, if I ever can have my own library, it's a real library, not books on the kitchen shelf and the sort of thing that I always had, then I would like it to look like this. I was extremely lucky in this Colegio Nacional de Buenos Aires because we had a few wonderful teachers, notably Isaías Lerner, who is sitting right there. And I try not to look at him because I feel that I'm going to get a mark at the end of this. But
by extension, I feel it too. So, you know, let's do our best.
It was largely thanks to Isaías Lerner that I found a way of reading books so that the book would open up to the rest of the world. We were supposed to read through the history of Spanish literature. Very wisely, Professor Lerner decided that we would only look at certain books, and we looked at those books in great depth. And I think it was by the time, when we did La Celestina, but by the time we got to Garcilaso de la Vega, and we studied in particular one sonnet, the sonnet of Dido finding Aeneas's clothing and knowing that he has left and saying, dulces prendas por mi mal halladas, and realizing that this spoke of heartbreaks, which every adolescent has, of a link to choices that you have to make in terms of loyalties. And also, and this simply as a reader, how you could dwell on the pure beauty of language, how you could simply enjoy the musicality of a line, and then begin to explore its difficulties. We are back to this concept of difficulty. And he didn't make things easy for us, but in not making things easy for us and in making us work for our pleasure, the pleasure was very long-lasting, so that now, 45 years later, I can wake up at night and have some of these lines ringing in my head, and they make me happy.
Let's talk a little bit about the difference between public libraries and private libraries.
Indeed.
I think you know, in Benjamin's essay, Unpacking My Library, a talk about collecting. In English, it's translated as a talk about book collecting. But in fact, Benjamin is interested in the very notion of collecting. Mm-hmm. He says in it a line that has always surprised me for a Marxist, that the deepest possible relationship, the most intimate relationship one can possibly have to objects is ownership.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, public libraries function in a different way. It's open to the general public.
That's why I have difficulties reading in public libraries. I love public libraries as spaces, and I visit them. But what happens is that the books I read, I want to own them because
I want
to write in them. Well, I want to interact with them.
Tell us more.
By the way, well, I think that the book is the most extraordinary interactive object we have invented. There isn't. We take it with us. We scribble on the margins. We begin to read it in any order we like. There is no program for reading a book. Anything that you read on the screen has been programmed for you. So I don't know where exactly the interactivity comes into play. But as far as the book is concerned, it is absolutely interactive. And a private library can be interactive in an absolute way. There is an anecdote that Chateaubriand tells about the French moralist Joseph Joubert. And Joubert boasted that in his library he only had the text that he loved. And he did this by tearing out the pages of that he didn't like. So the books were in a fairly bad shape, but it was true. And I call this interactive. Now, I can't do this.
And he wasn't trying to impress people by having big books. He had only the pages.
He didn't want to impress anyone. Yeah. He just wanted to have the books that he loved. And a private library is very much that. Because if you're honest as a reader, then the books you have, whether you like them or not, whether they are essential to you or not, you know that they describe who you are. I believe that every library is an autobiography, which is why when I'm in someone's house, one of the things I do, and I think most of us do, is look through the books that somebody has on the shelf, because it tells you so much about the person, and you know whether you can be friends with that person or not. Somebody who has the complete works of Houellebecq, for instance, I could not speak to for a very long time.
But someone who has...
Oh, the list is endless. Borges, of course. But the problem with Borges is that he can very easily become an obsession and infects everything that you do or say, and you no longer know whether what you're saying is something that you read in Borges or was inspired by Borges or... is your own. The Argentinian novelist Manuel Mujica Lainez was so fed up with people coming to him, young people, and saying how wonderful Borges was, that he wrote a little poem. It's called A un joven poeta. I'll say it in Spanish and I'll translate. Inútil es que te forjes idea de progresar, porque aunque escribas la mar, antes lo habrá escrito Borges. So it's useless for you to think of any idea of advancement, because whatever you write, how much you write, Borges will have written it first.
And Borges himself said something similar, if I remember, about every writer creates his own predecessors.
He said every writer creates his own precursors.
Precursor.
But this is true for readers, I think. I think what happens is that And God forbid that I should think of correcting Borges, but...
Maybe it's time, actually.
Oh, no.
No, in the sense of not having just veneration.
Yes, but maybe this is just my way of reading it. Borges is talking about Kafka, and he mentions a novel by Henry James, a short story by Lord Dunsany, The Paradoxes of Zeno, and he says... All these have something of Kafka, but if you look at them together without Kafka, they have nothing in common. So what they have in common is Kafka, who comes after them. And that is where he says every writer creates his own precursors. But what happens, of course, is that we, the readers, are the ones who create these precursors. We create our own chronologies. We read at random. We associate at random. And so if you read, for instance, Don Quixote before reading Kim, then your understanding of Kim will be different than if you read Kim and then you read Don Quixote, because the idea of friendship, the idea of a double adventure seen from both sides, the transformation of one into the other, and so on, is seen differently according to the order in which you read these books.
I want to come back to this notion of writer and reader in a minute. But before I do that, let's go back to the acquaintances you meet and the bookshelves you see and the friendships who may or may not develop depending on the books that they have or do not have on their shelves. I'm also very interested in that, and your the Library at Night really goes through this at great lengths in the notion of classification.
Yes.
And how the potential friend classifies his or her books. I remember Roland Barthes once said, tell me how you classify and I will tell you who you are. Mm. Talk a little bit about the notion of classification and the different kinds of classifications that work and the one that you are using now in your own newly found home.
I'm just wondering what Barthes would say, because I classify my books according to the language in which they were written.
And then, you mean what he would say about who you are?
Mm.
Well, this was, you know, I discovered this quotation when I was writing about collecting some years back, and I was teaching at the university, and a professor then of mine came in, and I told him this sentence, and my office was somewhere between chaos and entropy, somewhere right in the middle there. And I told him, you know, this line of Barthes, and he looked at me and said, "But who are you?" So of course, this directly makes us think about who we are, the different ways in which we classify. And you mention in your book Georges Perec, for instance, who has a truly wonderful essay about the different ways in which one possibly can classify
books.
Yes,
he gives
by
a long
color,
list of, yes.
By the latest book you received, by size.
And there again, it is very different whether you're classifying a public library or a private library, because obviously the code that you need for a public library needs to be accessible to others, while the code of your own library needs only be accessible to yourself. And to me, the greatest model of the private library is that of Abby Warburg. Abby Warburg, the great scholar, early 20th century, born into a family of Jewish bankers in Hamburg, and obsessed since a child with books and images, to the point that when he turned 13 and was supposed to go into the family business, he sold his right as eldest child to his 11-year-old brother on condition that the brother promised that he would buy him for the rest of his life as many books as he wanted. And the brother kept the promise, and Abby Warburg collected the magnificent library that was ordered according to Warburg's association of ideas. So the order of the library changed daily. Ernst Cassirer, who visited the library for after about 15 minutes, he asked to be let out because he said he would lose his mind. And Warburg had wonderful ideas about how you classified books. For instance, he invented the law of the good neighbor. The law of the good neighbor says that the information you are seeking is always in the book next to the book that you've pulled out. This generosity of thought transformed Warbeck's library into a reflection of his own mind. And I think you, based on the idea of Warbeck, you realize up to what point each of our libraries is a reflection of our own mind. It is, it has something to do with our way of thinking, of feeling. It is more than the reflection of our personality. It is the reflection of the way we truly are. And an alphabetical order or a numerical order simply codifies that. The reason, in fact, I wrote this book was a question around our idea of being able to order a library, because I wondered if what we know of the universe is how chaotic it is, how senseless it is, how its meaning escapes us, why do we think that what we know of the universe can have an alphabetical order or an order of any kind? Where does this optimism come from? And so I try to look at the different aspects of a library to see whether they would answer the question. And of course, I ended up with a question. Shall I read the last little bit?
The consolation part.
Yeah.
Yes, of course.
Just because I think it might explain things better. Just the last little bit.
But we're not ending there.
I hope not.
Okay.
St. John, in a moment of confusion, tells us not to love the world or the things that are in the world, because all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world. This injunction is at best a paradox. Our humble and astonishing inheritance is the world, and only the world, whose existence we constantly test and prove by telling ourselves stories about it. The suspicion that we in the world are made in the image of something wonderfully and chaotically coherent, far beyond our grasp, of which we are also part, the hope that our exploded cosmos and we, its stardust, have an ineffable meaning and method, the delight in retelling the old metaphor of the world as a book we read and in which we too are read, the conceit that what we can know of reality is an imagination made of language. All this finds its material manifestation in that self-portrait we call a library. And then I just this last little
Absolutely,
bit.
Absolutely, please.
In her novel, The Blue Flower, I really recommend that novel if you haven't read it, Penelope Fitzgerald. It's absolutely fantastic. And in this novel, Penelope Fitzgerald says, if a story begins with finding, it must end with searching. The story of my library certainly began with finding my books, finding the place in which to lodge them, finding the quiet in the space lit under the darkness outside. But if the story must end with searching, the question has to be, searching for what? Northrop Frye once observed that had he been present at the birth of Christ, he did not think he would have heard the angels singing. The reason why I think so, he wrote, is that I do not hear them now, and there is no reason to suppose that they have stopped. Therefore, I am not searching for revelation of any kind, since anything said to me is necessarily limited by what I'm capable of hearing and understanding. Not for knowledge beyond what in some secret way I already know. Not for illumination to which I can't reasonably aspire. Not for experience, since ultimately I can only become aware of what is already in me. For what then do I search at the end of my library story? Consolation, perhaps. Perhaps consolation. So that sort of gives a shape to the question, and of course doesn't provide an answer.
I have read that you have often resisted being classified, since we are talking about classification, as a writer. You have wanted, in a sense, to be classified as a writer-reader.
As a reader, and you can drop the writer.
I'm trying to get the writer in, since I do read you. But can you say something about that, and also say something about what constitutes, in your view, a true reader?
Well, let's quote Borges again. Borges said that a writer writes what he can, a reader reads what he wants. And this essential difference makes it clear to me that my limited talents might allow me to cobble together a few books, but that these books come from my reading. As a reader, however, I feel that my limits have no power. My power has no limits. My limits have no power. I don't know what that means.
It's an interesting idea.
It is, isn't it? However, in the times in which we're living, when the model for most of our activities is an industrial model, that is to say that the laws of pizza making and selling apply to every cultural object, including books, writers who have to make these things have to be enormously strong and brave if they're not going to produce these things that are sold in the chain bookstores and go under the name of books. And their power, unfortunately, is limited because how long can you last fighting against these big financial machineries? The reader, however, can. You see, as readers, we have the possibility of saying no to a huge amount of rubbish that is being thrust upon us and insist that we want to read something in which we can think. Again, Northrop Frye said that a good book is a book whose circumference is always larger than the best of its readers. And most of what is being offered today doesn't allow, let alone to reach its circumference, but even to perceive a center. So, like librarians, readers are mild creatures, but I think the time has come for a guerrilla movement. I think the time has come for us to, A, refuse to buy any books in any book chain. The time has come for us to say, I will only read a book if it helps me to think. And the time has come to say that we will not allow ourselves to be made even more stupid. In May 68, one of the slogans I loved was, "Je ne veux pas mourir idiot." I don't want to die an idiot. And I don't want to die an idiot, so I want to read books that are real books.
Yet, how does one, in a mild way, set up this guerrilla movement to work? Because just across the street from the New York Public Library, yet another bookstore, independent bookstore, Coliseum, is about to close. And I think I there's 6 or 8 independent bookstores in New York City. Mm. So how do you resist it?
You make the effort. Every time that you buy a book at Barnes & Noble's, you are nailing another nail into the coffin of another independent publisher, and bookseller, publishers as well, of course. It isn't easy, but there we go back to the notion of difficulty. There's nothing wrong with it being difficult. We have more time than we are led to believe.
I agree with you totally, up to a point.
I hear a but in the background.
No, you're flattering. Absolutely. And I agree with you totally up to a point, and the point was made very clearly to me. I mean, I really resisted it. I helped run an independent bookstore when I was a student 100 years ago at Princeton. Micawber Books, wonderful name for a bookstore. People used to call me up and ask for Mr. Micawber. But I, and it was a wonderful bookstore to be a part of. And yet I went to hear a discussion between Chris Anderson and Jeff Bezos, who runs Amazon, or owner, CEO of Amazon. And he made one point, and I wonder how you are going to react to it, which made me...
Nervously.
Yes, and I came... I have much, perhaps like yourself, always lived, or often lived, or sometimes lived, in metropolitan centers. And I have lived, whether it was in Brussels, or Paris, or Rome, or... now New York City or Los Angeles.
I know what you're going to say.
Okay, and so what do you do when your outlet is Kmart or Walmart or some such bookstore that has 2,000 books, of which 1,000 books are Christian books, and you have no place to go but online to find those books? Now, this is coming from somebody who considers himself not a son of modernity and also somewhat of a dinosaur. But still, the point was made quite clearly. In the middle of America, let us say North America, and perhaps even parts of Canada, you could live away from any bookstore. So what do you do?
I live in a small village. It has 6 houses, and there are no stores in the village. I buy books in Canada, in English. I buy books in England, and I buy books in France. And I buy them from independent bookstores because the post still works. And I can write a letter and post it to the bookstore, and the bookstore will get the books for me and send them to me. Now, all this takes time, of course, but...
And education of a sort. You need to know that you can do this.
Yes, of course, you need to know that you can do this. But apparently there is something called the Internet that provides information on all sorts of things. And one of the things that you can probably find on the Internet is that the Postal Service still works and that... There are a number of independent bookstores.
So you should Google independent bookstores on...
I would if I used the internet, certainly.
Now, I take it... No, I'm also a big fan of the Post. It's one of the few institutions
that
hasn't changed.
But look, no, I'm being silly because... No, hold on a minute. I'm being silly. Of course, there. If you need to... buy books, you go on. I don't, but you can go on Amazon.
Do you never
buy the
books?
No, I don't. I'll explain that later. But of course, you can do that if you have to. But I mean, our survival depends on small efforts, on turning off the running tap, on turning off the lights that you don't need, on not throwing away tons of garbage, on thousands of little gestures that need to be learned. One of these gestures is try to get your books at an independent bookstore. Of course, not everybody wants to do it or can do it, but if more and more of us at least reflect upon this, then perhaps something will in the end be saved. Nothing is promised. I mean, we don't know if we're going to survive the year 2050, where apparently the Earth will come to the end of its resources and the planet will finally say good riddance to us. But at least we can try. One thing that books do for us is not that they give us a solution, not that they teach us anything, not that they make us wiser, not that they make us better, not that they alleviate suffering. None of these things, except that they hold the possibility of these things. And over and over again, I'm amazed that if we reflect on our condition of as readers, we can find echoes of answers, we can find better forms of questions, we can find elements of dialogue that give us a reason to fight and to continue.
Because shards of hope in some way.
Otherwise, we might as well just give up now, because what we have built is a machinery bent on its own destruction. I compare it sometimes to, you remember 2001? A rocket is built, and the computer in the rocket is told that the mission is to reach Jupiter at all costs. What the programmers have forgotten to program in is accept at the cost of human life. And of course, the first thing that the computer does is eliminate human life, because this is the major obstacle for reaching Jupiter. I have the impression that we've built this economic machinery to which we have told profit at all costs, and we have forgotten to say except at the cost of human life. And we're going to end up with a huge fortune for no one, because there won't be anybody there.
Brings to mind Kafka's line, there's hope, but not for us.
Indeed. It's one of the funniest lines he has ever come up with.
Yeah. It's funny, it never really made me laugh, but I'll now.
I find it hilarious. It was Max Brod got so cross with him that he said, if you say that, then there is no hope. And Kafka stopped and smiled and said, there is hope, but not for us.
I was missing the context.
Apparently, he was hilariously funny. I met once somebody who knew him, and it's extraordinary how important these fetishistic moments can be, because this man had nothing interesting about him except that he had met Kafka, and he had...
Well, we all carry one little treasure. You
know? Absolutely, but what a treasure. Yeah. He had actually seen Kafka, and he had heard Kafka read. And apparently, people were howling with laughter.
You promised us that you would say some kind words about the internet and about Google. And as you know, we spoke a little bit earlier about the New York Public Library's efforts, together with other libraries, of working with Google. In your book, you're very critical of the internet in some way. Not that you think it needs to be excluded, and that in some way one can work well with online information, as long as one doesn't get away from what one might call the tactile inebriation books give us. So I'd love you to tell us a little bit how you feel about the current state of affairs, as it were.
Horace Walpole had a friend, a society lady, who one day in his presence gave a deep sigh and said, "Ah, I embrace the universe." And Walpole said, "You'd better." I don't think we have a choice. I embrace the electronic media.
But you don't.
Nobody's asking me the question.
But you don't because you don't use it, right?
I use it personally. Without wanting to use it. My television depends on it. My phone depends on it. My computer depends on it. All I ask is that I be allowed to judge when I need it and for what I need it. I don't think that my presence is indispensable to everyone in the world 24 hours a day. So I am not connected to the internet. I don't have email and I don't have a portable phone. And I survive. Of course it is. There is no question about the usefulness of the electronic media. That kind of question verges on the absurd.
But there's a difference in the way we approach knowledge if we approach it through...
Of course,
there is.
And there's nothing wrong with that. We keep inventing technologies. The clay tablet that the Assyrians held in their hand did not have enough memory. And therefore, the scroll was invented, which had enough memory, but only showed one part of the text at the time, and couldn't carry very much text. So the codex was invented because it was portable, because it allowed you to hold one page and look at another at the same time, because it had much more memory than a tablet. And it's an almost perfect object. I think it's one of the two or three perfect objects we have invented in our whole history. The wheel, can't perfect a wheel. A knife, maybe, and a book. But we can invent other technologies, and the electronic technology is, of course, extraordinarily useful for anything that requires quick and immediate reading. So that for instance, if we wanted to find out how many inhabitants there are in New York today, it would be ridiculous to use a printed book, because a printed book would be 6 months to a year out of date. So obviously you use the internet for that. But you would not sit down and read War and Peace on the internet. This is a trite example. Partly because it scrolls, which is what the codex was invented to avoid. However, when a new technology is invented, we know this, it sets out to use the vocabulary of the preceding technology and declares its death. So photography is invented, it uses the vocabulary of painting and says painting is dead. Of course painting isn't dead. And photography and painting use one another's vocabularies and so on with film and theater or television and video and so on. The electronic media and the book cohabit the space of the human imagination, and there's room for lots more. In 20 years' time, we'll be looking at the electronic technology and saying, this is old-fashioned, there's now somewhere else. My problem is not at all with its existence. As I say, it would be absurd to question it. It's there. We should use it for what it's useful for. But we should not declare that it's replacing anything. It's like inventing a jet plane and saying we'll do away with cars, and putting a jet plane on the street and saying that it consumes a lot of gas and doesn't turn corners. That's not what it's made for. And the electronic media is not the best way to read a text in depth. Now, since you mentioned Google and the libraries, Google has offered to put online hundreds of thousands of pages of text, which is fine if you want a manuscript that's in the National Library of Reykjavik and you can't go to Iceland and you can find this on the screen. That's fine. But let's not confuse that with reading a book. And there are dozens of differences. First of all, it's scanned, and scanning makes mistakes. Secondly, the technology that is now encoding the book will certainly be obsolete in a year or two, and we will have to have retrieval systems that will allow us to read them. The British Library spent a huge amount of money doing an electronic version of a doomsday book, which it can't read now. There is no technology to read it. So we have to be careful with those things. We also have to say that Google, to my knowledge, is not a philanthropic society. So the question in Roman law, cui bono, applies. Who does this benefit? Whom does this benefit? And finally, of course, everyone is terribly enthusiastic that the whole Latin corpus and Greek corpus is available online. Fine, yes. But those texts exist because of a whole critical apparatus and an editorial establishing of text that has taken a huge amount of effort from generations and generations of scholars. And so what text are we putting online? If it is the text of a certain scholar, that scholar should be acknowledged and money should be paid for him. Because that is yet another question. This will be the last point regarding this putting text on the internet. The question of copyright is not a trivial question, because I am fully willing to give up the copyright on my little books the day that dentists will give service for free and bankers will be banking for free and so on and so forth. I don't see why writers should be selected as the ones to be sacrificed to the altar of Google's notion of public culture.
A couple more quick questions. In your perception, what will the library of the future feel like?
Let me see my crystal ball. I have absolutely no idea. Absolutely no idea. First, I hope we'll survive. Then I hope books will survive. Well, maybe both things have to coincide for us to survive. No, I have no idea. I fear very much a profession called futurologist. I can't barely pronounce their name. Apparently, they take part in the planning of new libraries and usually suggest that space should not be wasted on bookshelves since books are obsolete. So I don't know what the library of the future will be like. I hope it's not Bradbury's vision of the readers.
You talk a little bit about the Alexandria Library, where there are no books, or nearly no books now, which is quite
the
ironic.
New Library of Alexandria. Yes, which is largely a virtual library with empty bookshelves. But since you mentioned Alexandria, I think that it is useful to remember what the Library of Alexandria stood for. The Library of Alexandria that wanted to house all the books in the world realized very quickly that it needed systems of retrieval, and the first librarians of Alexandria saw as their main task that of selecting books for readers and constructing canons that were annotated so that readers would go in and know where, what to read, where to go. Unfortunately, what happened was that those canons were preserved and hundreds and thousands of books were forgotten. So Alexandria, in some sense, symbolically tells us what we know about every library, that we want to hold all, but in holding all, we will lose much. That every order and every habit of collecting necessarily constructs a library of the shadows, of that which we haven't collected, that we haven't preserved, of that which we have voluntarily or involuntarily censored. And what have we lost in that which we haven't chosen? And maybe here I can think of a line. It's Tom Stoppard in his play The Invention of Love who mentions this, And I was so moved when I heard this, of Sophocles' 120 plays, seven have survived. And one of the plays that we know he wrote, and which we don't have, is called The Loves of Achilles. And all we have of The Loves of Achilles is one line which a father during the Renaissance wrote in a copybook for his son. He's writing a list of phrases that he thought his son should have. And the line from this lost play is, "Love is like a piece of ice in the hands of a child." The knowledge that 113 plays of Sophocles were lost, and of that immense mass, this line remains, somehow in a perverse way, gives me hope.
Because it speaks of the power of what remains.
Because it tells us that something does remain.
And finally, before we open it up to your good questions, and let me just say something about questions. In my experience, questions can be asked in about 58 seconds or so. Finally, since this evening has been called The Library at Night, and since your book is called by the same name, if we were to lock you up tonight in this library, what do you think you might do?
Sleep. I imagine I would try to explore at least a part of it. The library at night, libraries at night, have for me a special attraction, because this is the conceit that more or less structures the book, that during the day the order of a library is so visible, so imposing, that I feel reluctant to disobey the structures that are given to me. At night it's different. Perhaps it's because cones of light only illuminate certain sections, and those sections are random, and the association of between certain books allow for a kind of creative chaos, for a place to think more freely. So my notion of the library at night is an acceptance of the order of the library, and at the same time finding a way for my own freedom within that structure.
We will open up the room to questions. There are mics, I think, that will be passed to you. And after this Q&A period, there will be a reception to which you're all invited. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you. Thank you.
Please. If you could stand up.
Actually, I hate to start, because I sort of want to take exception with a couple of things that you said.
Please do.
The first is I actually really applaud what Google is doing in terms of putting documents online. I agree. I love to read and I love to hold a book. but certainly the books that they are planning to put online are not under copyright, and they do respect that. The other thing is that when I moved into the neighborhood I live in now in Manhattan, not far from here, I'm a huge supporter of independent bookstores. And there was an independent bookstore half a mile away, and it was terrible. You went in there, they were not helpful, and they were not willing to order things, did not have a big selection. And I'm very happy being both an Amazon and a Barnes & Noble buyer, because I believe it does give me a broader selection And I think that's why I'm a supporter of the library, is because I believe it brings that broader selection to a lot of people.
Is there a question?
No, it's actually, it's sort of more... Okay.
Absolutely right. Unfortunately, the causes I find I want to defend are not represented much of the time by the nicest or most efficient of people. There's nothing you can do about that. Obviously, with more money, more time, more resources, a Barnes & Noble bookstore will offer all sorts of attractions that private bookseller may not be able to offer. And, of course, that private bookseller may be a horrible person who has no idea of how to court his or her customers. All that is true. And yet, for me, that doesn't take away what I feel is the noxiousness of the chains and the importance of the private bookseller. Would that our causes were always rewarded by beautiful, lovely people on the other end, and that the damsels in distress that we go out to rescue were not horrible creatures, but a lot of the time they are, and nevertheless I feel that they're worth rescuing. As far as Google is concerned, I have not said that I don't think the idea... I think that the idea of putting books online is a very good idea. I just want to be cautious about it. I just distrust whatever is imposed. We don't have a choice about how this is done. When millions of dollars are offered to do something, we don't ask a lot of questions, and I think that we should. I don't know whether we can... Pardon? They don't respect copyright. Yes. And that is a problem. If you are a writer and you try to live off your writing, which is nigh impossible, it is important that you should be paid for the work you do. So...
Thank you. I am a librarian, or at least I was for 20 years. Wait. I was a librarian until I suffered such a debilitating midlife crisis that I went to law school and became an attorney. But I look back fondly on my old profession. I, for nostalgic purposes, Google job offers and library schools. And I find that it's very sad. Library schools are being closed. There are not a lot of job openings. So could you give us an idea in this internet age of where do you think that the profession of librarianship is going?
Where the profession of librarians would be going, did you say? I think a librarian should be a librarian. It's not up to the librarian to find new ways to be a librarian. It is up to us as a society to protect the idea of the importance of the role of the librarian and the role of the library and the role of the books. I think that we live in a paradox that on the one hand, we do complain that all these clichés, that young people don't read, that that reading is not important, that the book is in decline, and so on. And on the other hand, we don't, as a society, offer any examples of our true belief in the importance of the book. And this is an ongoing thing. At the end of the 19th century, John Ruskin was asked by the good people of Manchester to suggest a statue for the center of the city that wanted to pride itself in its culture. John Ruskin suggested a statue to Mammon because he said that is the only god that you adore. I think he would say the same thing today. So to answer your question briefly, I don't think it's up to the librarian to redefine the job. It's up to society to insist on the importance of the traditional role of the librarian. And this does not include only looking after books and recommending books. It never was. The Library of Alexandria had a wonderful collection of art objects, and it was a place where scholars met, and we don't know anything about the building itself, but we know about the activities at the museum. The library was only a small part of it.
United States has declined. Its books are no longer stitched, they use acid-free paper, but they're glued, and they fall apart after a very short period of time. And electronic books, in some ways, have taken over that. I mean, they've dealt with that problem, and the technology of the book has not. You know, it's expensive to stitch books now, don't you think?
It's expensive, but bookmaking was always an expensive business, only that it was considered important enough to do. And part of the problem of producing books that fall apart is that we are creating books that don't need to live longer than a month. So why have a Judith Krantz novel that will last several centuries? But in any case, the idea that the electronic technology is longer lasting and more resilient than paper is not proven. This is what they said when I first bought a computer and was told that my diskettes would last for centuries. They lasted 6 years. As far as the memory stick is concerned, I have my doubts as to what will happen with the technology. On the other hand, some time ago I was in the Archaeological Museum in Naples, and there between two pieces of glass were ashes from a papyrus recovered in Pompeii. And it had been buried under the lava of Vesuvius, burnt by the ashes, and you could still read the writing. I hope that our electronic technology will have a little of that kind of immortality.
Thank you.
Please, to venture into the personal, is it possible that you chose France because France is a country where intellectual ideas are valued, where cafe society exists, and where people prize thoughts, in addition to cuisine and other?
Everything you said is true. I'm afraid my reasons were much more prosaic because I was looking for a place in which I could lodge the library that would also be affordable. And I found this in this area of France. And while everything you say is true, and I've always admired the fact that some 20 years ago, when the essential products of society were indexed in France, that is to say that the prices couldn't be raised without government approval. There were four things chosen: milk, bread, wine, and livre de poche. So Yes, that is a cultured society. On the other hand, we must remember that it is also the society that has now produced Monsieur Sarkozy. I will say no more.
I have found that in the course of reading a book, it often comes to own me as much as I own it. We both leave our marks on each other. Yes. And I think that it helps.